Okay, we were discussing last week the what the pasuk describes as Harim Yad, raising his hand against the king, that Yerubbaam was guilty of certain acts of rebelliousness against Shlomo HaMelech. One was that he was mochiach him berabim, right? He criticized him in public, and although the criticism itself was valid, it should not have been done in public. And the second, which we were discussing, was that he removed his tefillin in front of him. What exactly is wrong with removing your tefillin in front of him? So we mentioned Rashi's sheet is that it's your megala rosh, you uncover your head, either to take the tefillin off, or maybe there was gili rosh, also not so clear. But that was an act of rebellion. We mentioned there are other opinions. The Ramah says in the Darkei Moshe that when a person wears tefillin, there are certain activities that are prohibited because they are considered to be somewhat kalas rosh. Of course, real kalas rosh is prohibited regardless of whether you're wearing your tefillin or not. But certain types of activities which are not the most bekavedik, you're not supposed to do with your tefillin on. In a similar way, those same types of activities that are prohibited with your tefillin on are also prohibited in front of a king or in front of a rebbe. So by taking off your tefillin, it's kind of like sending a subtle message, I'm ready to do these types of activities. If you take your tefillin off in the presence of the king, it's as if to say, with my tefillin on, I wouldn't do such a thing, because I have covered for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the king doesn't bother me. So that is an act of Harim Yad Keneged HaMelech. I mentioned this last week, that when going through these Mari Mekomos, I felt a certain sense of Chalishas Hadas, of how remote our concept of covet is today. And we mentioned last time that, you know, today when a person becomes, we don't have kings per se, I guess there are some places that still have kings, but they ain't what they used to be. But, you know, when a person achieves positions of leadership, he becomes a target for every comedian and every, you know, cartoonist and every, you know, imitator. And it's bizyonos. And the whole process of becoming elected is bizyonos. You know, everyone has to attack each other. I mentioned this before, but it bears repeating. My father gave me a good mashal. He says, imagine a shul is hiring a new rabbi. So you have a search committee. So the candidates come before the search committee, and the candidate says, listen, I am a great rabbi. You should see what I did in the last shul I was serving in. We increased the membership, all kinds of activities. And, you know, I could reach the young. And look at my opponent. What did he do in his shul? What a disaster it was. And besides, you hear all the rumors about him. And you run away from that guy. That's what you do to get elected. So the whole process is bizyonos. And in general, society does not have covet. You know, the concept of honor, covet, is very, very lacking in Western society. And it's a very, very devastating thing, because for us, covet is a huge deal. Because the whole future of Klal Yisrael is totally dependent on the transmission of the Mesorah from generation to generation. And that can only happen if there's a respect. The younger one, people have to respect the older generation. And there has to be a respect for Torah and respect for the people who represent Torah. And when you don't have that respect, all right, I'll take it, I'll leave it. And even though it's true that we are, as usually, far better than the society around us, nevertheless, we are affected. And we're not what we should be. And without that cover, the Mesorah can't be properly transmitted. It comes to mind the story of Yaakov Kamenetsky, who was flying on an airplane with a grandson. And his grandson was waiting on him hand and foot the entire flight, running back and forth. Can I get you water? Can I do this? Can I do that? He was sitting next to a fellow who was a professor, a chiloni, Israeli secular person, was a professor at university. And he was observing this. So the professor said to Rabbi Yaakov, I don't understand how you get your grandchildren to do that. My grandchildren, I'm lucky if they say hello. Maybe, you know, they'll give me a perfunctory call, you know, on my birthday or something. And they don't want to have anything to do with me. And here, you know, he's running around waiting on you hand and foot. So Rabbi Yaakov said, it's a very simple explanation. He says, you are a secularist, and you believe in evolution. So you are two generations closer to a monkey. Why should he respect you? But we believe in Maimon Har Sinai. And I'm two generations closer to Har Sinai. That's why my grandson treats me like this. Now, Rav Yaakov was being somewhat modest, because I imagine being Rav Yaakov had something to do with it too. But the essence of what he's saying is very true, that the Masorah works because we recognize that it's closer to Har Sinai, and we have to have a certain sense of respect for that. And if the whole idea of covet is foreign to us, we struggle. I am sure no one has to admit this, but I'll admit it because I'm giving the shir. When I'm going through these Marmikamos, it's like, okay, you know, that's a rebellion. That's so terrible. He took off his tefillin. I bet he exposed his head for a moment. You know, it sends an indirect message. Who says he wanted to do something that was kalistic? You know, he didn't do anything that was kalistic. It doesn't say he took off his tefillin and started to, whatever it was, dance around and do whatever it was. That he only took off his tefillin because it sends a certain message. That's a chisar and kavod. Maybe after thinking about it a little bit, I guess I could hear it. That's a little bit of chisar and kavod. Plus, because of Hey Rimiyad, it's almost like a rebellion. He had to run for his life. There is a we just don't feel it, and it's you know, a scary thought. We have something that we need to sort of focus on. All of course, there are many, many negative influences in society, but we should be aware that this is one of them, and we need to, you know, avoid falling into that trap of total irreverence and lack of cover. Okay, Perek Yilav Pasuk Chav Ches. Va'ish Yeravam Gibar Chayel, and the man Yeravam was very Gibar Chayel, a valorous, strong person. What we would call that today, the real terminology we mean by that is really that he was competent, that he was able to get things done, he was successful. So he was extremely competent. Va'yar Shlomo es Hanar, and Shlomo saw the boy ki osim lachu, that he could work, he could do a good job. He put him in charge of all the burdens of the household of Yosef, which is Ephraim and Menashe. He was from Ephraim, Pashtus, and put him in charge of those Shvatim. When did this take place? So most of the Mefarshim, Rashi, Radak, learned that this is a retrospect. This took place before those acts of rebellion that we were talking about, Yeravam. The pasuk is sort of backing up and saying that when Yeravam was younger, he caught the attention of Shlomo HaMelech because he saw that he was also Malach, he got the job done, and he was a very competent person, and he put him in charge of Yosef and of the Shevet Shvatim of Yosef. And therefore, the implication is, it went to his head a bit. He began to feel very, he may have been very young, when he was put in charge, Pasuk refers to him as Nar, and he felt the you know, and it went to his head a little bit. And even though, as we mentioned before, we will mention again shortly, that Yeravam actually was a greatly accomplished person and had many great miles, had the potential to be great, but he declined. He fell victim to the Nisyonos of Gaiva and Kavod. But this is sort of how that started to happen. And in fact, some Mefarshim, the Radak, suggests that the next pasuk also took place earlier. The next pasuk, we'll look at it inside in a moment, but Yeravam meets up with Achya Shiloni, the great Navi, and Achya informs him that he will be a king and take over the Ten Shvatim. That also happened before Yeravam was Harim Yad, and that also contributed to his attitude. When he was told he's going to be the next king, and Shlomo was a Chote, so he felt emboldened to do the things that he did, which Afal Pi Kein, despite the fact that he was destined to be king, were still improper because he wasn't king yet, and Shlomo, whatever Shatayim were, was still a great person, and he should not have done it. So that is one approach. The Kli Yakar suggests another approach. In the end, he sort of concedes to Rashi and the Rishonim, but we'll go through the Mahal because it's an interesting take. The Kli Yakar wants to suggest that it's possible that these psukim are chronological, and that this took place after the acts of Yeravam, and this was Shlomo's strategy to try to neutralize Yeravam. He saw that Yeravam was getting somewhat rebellious. On the other hand, Yeravam was a very competent person. So he said, I'll tell you what, I'll put him in charge of the Shvatim of Yosef. Several things might be accomplished. Number one, he's going to leave Yerushalayim. He has to go out to the outlying areas, and he's not hanging around where he could foment trouble and cause revolution. Number two, if he is being chutzpahdik towards me, maybe he has a need to be, to feed his ego, to feed his kavod. He needs to be in charge. So if I give him a position that puts him in charge, maybe he'll be satisfied. Or at least they will tone him down. Now he has a pesa melucha. It's not a melech, but he has Yosef. He's in charge of the Shvatim. So maybe that will soften his drive. And thirdly, he said, quotes the famous pasuk regarding when Yoshua was complaining to Moshe about Eldad and Medad. He said, Adoni Moshe Kilaim. One of the interpretations of Chazal is, he said, my master Moshe put them in charge of something. They will fall apart by themselves. People tend to be big talkers, and they're always there to criticize and to complain. But if you give them responsibility, they can't handle it. The burden gets them, and all of a sudden, it's not so simple anymore. So that was Yeshua's time. Adoni Moshe Kilaim. So this was Shlomo's Kavana too. You're such a big talker. Let's put you in charge. Let's see what happens. Lamaisa, it didn't work out. It didn't stop Yeravam. Maybe if you learn his mahalach, he met up with meeting up with Achi also took place afterwards, and maybe that reinforced him that he's going to be a king. He wasn't going to satisfy himself just to be in charge of Yosef. And interestingly enough, the svar of Adoni Moshe Kilaim is not foolproof. Most of the time, the people who are the biggest loudmouths and the biggest complainers really can't get anything done themselves. If you put them in charge, and Adoni Moshe Kilaim is a very good strategy. That's most of the time, but you do have your exceptions. And sometimes a person talk is a loudmouth complainer, then he does get things done. I have a very vivid recollection when I was in Miami. We had a need to get a new building for our elementary school, and it wasn't so easy as we didn't have too much money. At the same time, there was a kind of scenario playing out in North Miami Beach. It was somewhat of a threatened community. There were a lot of blacks in the neighborhood, a lot of crime, and people were worried about it. Some people were leaving. And there was a large conservative synagogue that had signed a contract to sell their product. They were moving to a different neighborhood, and they were selling their building to a church. And we won't get into too many details if we're on the air exactly what kind of church, but let's just say that Reverend Jeremiah Wright might have been at home in such a church. And it caused a lot of fear in the community. So there was a number of people who were saying that Torah Semis needs a new building, let them buy the building. We actually did buy the building in the end. The price is a little inflated. And even at a fair price, I don't think we could have bought it but so easily, but the price was inflated. But there was one particular fellow in the community who was really complaining loudly, and what's the matter with Torah Semis? Why don't they buy the building? And the neighborhood needs it, and this and that. And in the meantime, he had never done anything. So there was another gentleman who was the vice president of the school. Basically confronted me, you're such a big mouth, you're complaining, why don't you do something about it? The guy said, okay. He says, you want to buy the building? I said, we had the money, we'd buy the building. He says, fine. He organized a campaign, made a parlor meeting in his house, or we had a second parlor meeting afterwards. As this is going on, I remember speaking to our board of directors, and they asked us, how much money do you think you could raise in North Miami Beach besides our regular supporters because of this project? And they didn't have a great record of giving tzedakah. It wasn't a wealthy community. I remember saying, I think maybe $50,000. We're talking about a $2.5 million purchase plus another million and a half, maybe more, in renovations and construction. So $50,000 doesn't really go very far. In two and a half weeks, it raised about $500,000. The parlor meeting at this guy's house raised $300,000. And I'm saying, you know, sometimes, I was totally shocked. Once in a while, you get this guy, he was a lama, and he got it done. So we did buy the building. Of course, we didn't raise all the money we needed for it. We tried to get financing. And we had a lot of connections to different banks through different balabatim. What I discovered during that process is that it makes a very big difference when you in the banking industry if you have connections. If you have no connections in a bank, you meet with some loan officer who will tell you no. If you have connections, you get to meet with a senior vice president who will tell you no. So I met with several senior vice presidents of banks, including one bank. And apparently this fellow had assumed, I didn't really know until this meeting, but there was a big fancy shul in Bell Harbor, the shul of Bell Harbor. It was a $12 million project. And they raised $11 million and they borrowed $1 million from this bank to finish the project, which I didn't know. He assumed Orthodox Jews, you must know everything that's going on. So he was sort of excusing himself why he did that loan, he's not doing our loan. He says, you know, it's a big difference between the two projects. That's a $12 million project. They have $11 million and they're borrowing $1 million. That's one thing. But yours is a $2.5 million project. All you have is $1.5 million, you're borrowing $1 million. That's a different story. And I'm thinking in my mind, I wish we had the $1.5 million. It was more like maybe 700,000. But Baruch Hashem, it worked out somehow. But the point is that someone may, according to this interpretation, Shlomo may have thought that putting Yerovim in charge would cause him to crumble under the pressure. The fact of the matter was, it wasn't so. Yerovim was capable of handling it. The Kli Yakar concludes, however, that the Pasuk is really more mashma like Rashi, and Radak, and others because of the use of the word nar. If you look in the Pasuk, it says, V'ish Yerovim Gibor Chayil, V'yashlam es hanar, why would you call him a nar when he's a fully grown adult? So the implication is we're going back in time. Shlomo first noticed Yerovim when he was nar, when he was young. And I already put him in charge. And then he became a Ish Rabban Gibor Chayil, who was the one who caused trouble to Shlomo HaMelech.
Isn't it not, he was immature sometimes, like making mistakes or something?
Yeah, okay. But that wouldn't fit into this context because this pasuk doesn't deal with his mistakes. Okay, so now we have the historic meeting between Yerovam and Achia Shiloni. Pasuk Chavtes, Vayhi Ba'esahi, it came to pass at that time, V'yiravam Yatzam Yerushalayim, again, the time isn't clear. There are those who say this took place many years earlier, before the Yerovam started up with Shlomo. Others say this took place afterwards. But whatever it may be, Yerovam is Yatzam Yerushalayim, Vayimtza osa Achia Shiloni Hanavi, and Achia Shiloni the Navi found him, Baderach on the way, Vehu miskasa besama chadash, and he was wearing a new garment, unclear who the he was. Was it Achia who was wearing a new garment, or was it Yerovam who was wearing a new garment? And in any case, why do we care that he was wearing a new garment? So we will see as we analyze this, but I'm going to take the two psukim together. Ushneim levadim basada, and they are both alone in the field. Vayispos Achia basalma chadasha asher alav, and Achia took a hold of this new garment that was upon him, whoever the him may be. Vayikraeha, and he tore it shneim asher kroim into 12 segments. And this is going to be the nevuah that the shvatim are going to be divided. As the pasuk will go on to say, you take 10 segments, other 2 segments remain with Malchus Beis David. Now, just a reminder, we mentioned this before, but the drushas are really on this pasuk, that the Salma Chadasha is darshan to mean, referring to the Torah of Yerovam, was like a Salma Chadasha, a new garment, Just like a new garment has no flaws, it's brand new. There are no stains, no tears, no snags. So too, the Torah of Yerubbaam before his downfall was Ein Bo Dofi. There was nothing wrong with it. That means not just that he was smart and could learn good pshat, because we know Torah doesn't work like that. In order to really get to the emes of Torah, you have to have midos tovos, you have to have anava, you have to learn Torah lishma. If you look in the brayse at the end of Pirkei Avos that lists the 48 means with which Torah is acquired, the majority of them have nothing to do with academics. There are some that do, but and none have to do with brilliance. But the diligence and listening and reviewing, okay, those are academic things. But many of them have to do with midos, with proper respect and humility, and so on. So Yerubbaam really was a great person. The other drasha, Shneim Levadim Basodeh, the two of them were alone in the field. Chazal say that they were the only ones on that level of learning, and compared to them, everyone else was like the grass of the field. The Kli Yoker adds further, and he connects the two drushes, that he says, a Salma, when the Torah is referred to as a Salma, Salma is something that has to be manufactured. Right? Clothing doesn't grow in trees. Torah is compared to many things. Torah is compared to water. Water you can find naturally. Torah is compared to olives. The Torah is compared to Salma. Somebody has to make a Beged. So what this is referring to is not Torah per se, but Chidushei Torah. That to go ahead and to learn and to delve into Torah and figure out an insight. So he says, Achya and Yerubbaam were learning together in the field. And they came up with Chidushim that nobody else in their generation was able to come up with. That's Shneim Levadim Basodeh. So they not only was Yerubbaam great, he was a Chavrusa with Achya Hashiloni. And together, they figured out Chidushei Torah that others were incapable of doing. So the so there was greatness, a potential for greatness, and at one point there was greatness in Yerubbaam, but he declined dramatically. Why was it necessary to tear the garment? Achya came with the nevuah. It wasn't so difficult to explain the nevuah, to tell him that there are going to be 10 a split amongst Kali Yisrael, and 10 Shvatim will go with you, and 2 will remain with Yehuda. Why do you have to tear the garment? So the Mefarshim say, and we find this in other places in Navi as well, where nevuahs are not simply spoken but acted out. What makes this perhaps a little bit more difficult than the other situations is that it was done in private. If a nevuah is acted out in public, so you might say it's for a dramatic effect, it's to impress the people, people will remember it. But this was a private conversation with Achishloni and Yerubbaam. L'chori didn't need that. The Mefarshim say that when a nevuah is acted out, it means that this nevuah is, so to speak, cast in stone. Sometimes a nevuah has been given, but tshuva, tefillah, something could avert the decree. But when it's decided before HaKadosh Baruch Hu that there's no turning back, so then the nevuah is given in an active form. So this was the reason why this was acted out. Now I mentioned that there's actually a machlokus tanoim, whose garment it was. What were they tearing? So one man d'yomer holds it was Yerubbaam's, one man d'yomer holds it was Achya's, and Rav Shimon Gamliel is machria that it was Achya, because darkan shel tzadikim is the way of tzadikim to mourn when there is a machlokus in Malchus Beis David. In other words, tearing is also a sign of avelus. When a person loses a close relative, you tear kriya. So this was a form of tearing kriya. Achya Hashiloni was saying, this is not a good thing. This is a terrible disaster for Klal Yisrael, that there should be a machlokus and malchus based David. Unfortunately, this is the decree, this is what's happening. So it was an expression of his avelus. And in fact, he was tearing a new garment to point out that it was such avelos that he didn't care that it was a new garment. Usually a person has to tear kriya, they know they're going to have to tear kriya, they wear an old garment, because you're going to ruin the garment, so you wear an old garment. not to have a hefset. But Achya wore dafka new garment because it was a greater expression of his mourning and the pain that he felt.
Why would you run be haughty after, you know, this Nerur? I mean, it seems like it's a sad situation that he's going to come into.
Right, but he, you know, everything, as they say, is a question of perspective. For him, he's becoming king. So he has a little bit of a little different. He looked at it like, oh, but okay, maybe it's a bad thing overall, but look at me, I'm being chosen to be the leader of the Aseret HaShvatim.
And Rosh Hashanah, was he anointed at this moment?
He was never anointed.
Okay,
we'll get into that a little bit later, but there's a whole big shy whether you're allowed to anoint somebody who's not from Malchus Beis David. But he was not anointed, he was appointed. We will discuss a little bit of, I think we'll probably get started on it today, but the whole idea of Malchus Beis David and how this was done.
I understand that the fact that Shlomo lost a significant portion of the Melucha, the Beis David lost, that was an onus for Shlomo, but it seems to be Klal Yisrael is pretty significantly affected by it. Was there a particular onus that Klal Yisrael was deserving of?
Well, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, at least according to Rashi, we'll get into that too, says that the main taina of Klal Yisrael was for rejecting Malchus Beis David. If you're familiar with what happened, Yerubim didn't come in and take over the kingdom. Right? He didn't come with an army and rebel against Rechavam and take over the kingdom. It was the other way around. Klal Yisrael rebelled against Rechavam. Because Rechavim they came with a complaint that the taxation and the burdens that Shlomo imposed were too great. And the Zakenim advised Rechavim to lighten up. And the younger advisors advised him to get even tougher. Don't let them think that you're a pushover. And he went with the young advisors and he got really tough. He says, you think Shlomo was bad, wait till you see me. And as a result, they rebelled against him, and they separated from the kingdom of Rechavam, and then they went and appointed Yerubim, or accepted Yerubim. So Klal Yisrael themselves were the ones who made this split happen, and that was their chet.
This is even prior.
This is a nevuah. This is a nevuah. They're telling you what's going to happen. Now that raises the question, there was a nevuah, so what was the chet? We'll get to that. But that seems to be the indication. Now, Chazal have another drush on this pasuk. It says, "Vahi beis hi v'yiravam yatzam Yerushalayim." So that really seems to be the unnecessary phrase. It isn't really important to the story where Yerubim was coming from. It could have just said, "Vahi beis hi v'yimsa achya achshiloni Yerubim baderek," and he said, "Whatever, he's traveling." So Yatzam Yerushalayim, says Chazal, has a deeper significance. It says Yatzam Mipiska Shel Yerushalayim. Piska is like a kind of a star. A piska is like the contract, the deed. He's left what Yerushalayim symbolized. It's not a physical act of leaving the city. He was leaving Yerushalayim. What does Yerushalayim symbolize? The essence of Yerushalayim, in the eyes of Chazal, captured in the pasuk in Tehillim, Ki'ir Shechur B'la Yachtav, Yerushalayim is a city that symbolizes the connection between the physical world and the spiritual world. We say everything in Yerushalayim has connected, Yerushalayim Shalmaila, and this is the connecting point of the spiritual world and the physical world, which, and if you think about it, is ultimately the whole purpose of being in this world. Human beings are placed in this world in a physical form, with a guf, with a body, and their job is to bring ruchnius into the physical world. And they have the challenges, you have the drives of the Eitz Sahara, but you have the tzivuyim of the Torah, you have the Eitz Tov, you have your Bechira, and that's what it's all about. So leaving Yerushalayim is abandoning that challenge to bring the ruchnius into the world. So that means Yerubim already at this point had begun his decline. And this Again, the timing of this meeting is unclear, but whatever it may be, certainly if this meeting took place after he rebelled against Shlomo, then it's very understandable. But even if the meeting took place before, but what it means is the seeds, the beginning of that process, had already begun. Something had taken hold in Yerubim's personality. He had succumbed already to some extent that he was beginning on this process to decline. Not that it could not have been reversed, right? If he was at the point that he was already irreversible, then Mistama would not have been appointed king. He was still right to be the king, but the process already begun. And in essence, this is really how usually, not always, but usually life goes. On the positive side, we find an expression, Yesh kon olamo b'shah achas. Sometimes a person could acquire his old world in one moment, and the Gemara gives stories of people who are terrible rishonim, and they did phenomenal tshuva and turned everything around. In general, the process usually involves death of the person. So if anybody thinks it's a good mahalach to Yesh kon olamo b'shah achas, you should just know there are side effects. But Yesh kon olamo b'shah achas. What about everybody else? All the Tanoim and all the Amaraim, it doesn't say such stories about them. Because usually the way your kon olamo is in little itty bitty steps, one at a time, one building on the other, making steady progress, sometimes falling back a bit, but picking yourself up and continuing forward. And that's the struggle of life. And people do not generally make dramatic improvements. They make little tiny ones, and sometimes you can't even notice it. And you have to look back over time to see that you've made progress. And of course, this is the famous mashal of Rabbi Akiva. When Rabbi Akiva was contemplating whether it was kedai for him to devote himself to learning Torah, and he had doubts, according to the Mefarshim, whether Torah could really make a difference. Because he didn't see the change when people learned Torah. And then he saw the water dripping on a rock. And that was his mashal. When water drips on a rock, you don't see the change either. But if you come back, whatever, 1,000 years later, there's a hole in the rock. So clearly the water was making a change. That's usually how Torah works. In a similar way, on the downside, we say, Al-Tamin Ba'asacha Yom Moscha, and the Gemara tells a story of a person, whoever he was, some disputes about who he was, but Yochanan Kohen Gadol served with righteousness for 80 years, and then became a tzaduki on the last day of his life. So you do have people who dramatically decline. But usually, that's not how people decline. As the Gemara tells us, the way of the Yetzirah is he first comes as a thread, and then he winds more threads and becomes like a string. And then there are more strings and becomes like a rope. And then becomes like the rope of the ships, thick, thick, heavy rope. So it doesn't usually start right away with the biggest chait. It starts with a very small, indiscernible little steps, and then they build, and if you don't stop the process, you decline more and more, and then eventually a person becomes a Rasha. But it's not, again, it happens. Sometimes you'll find a person who was a tzaddik and suddenly becomes a Rasha, but it isn't usually the case, nor was it the case with Yerubam. Yerubam started off Yotzam Episkei Shulayim, but you wouldn't have noticed it. And at that point in time, he hadn't done anything so terrible, but he declined, and it got worse and worse, and eventually he became the infamous Yerubam ben Nevat. Yes?
If it's so unusual, why do they say that you can trust yourself until even the day of your death because of, for example, of Yochanan ben Gadol?
Yeah, it doesn't mean you still can't trust. I don't know how unusual it is, but it is unusual, but it could happen. You can't trust yourself. What's more likely to happen is a person who trusts himself will start declining, and that's not necessarily plunge in one day, but you will deteriorate. But
that shot in that mindset that he trusted himself, and therefore he was able to fall.
I don't know. It doesn't say that per se, but the mindset, whatever it was, no details are given as to what happened, what his nisayon was, why it happened. But usually, that's not how decline takes place. It takes place in stages, and in fact, we just recently read in Bichukosai, Timasu, etc., etc. You look in Rashi, and there Rashi goes through the stages. The first stage is Eina Amelim Batorah. You're not working hard. It doesn't mean to say you're not learning, but you're not working hard at your learning. That's stage one. The last stage is you call for everything. But it doesn't happen instantly. It goes usually. Again, it's possible, and you can't trust yourself. You never know. But certainly you can't trust yourself because of the increments. But generally, the way it goes is in stages. So Yerovam was already Yasam Episkos Yerushalayim even before he committed any of his terrible chataim. But he had already declined in small stages. At that point, maybe he wouldn't have done the chataim that he did later. And when he was Mochiach, for example, Shlomo, because Shlomo made it more difficult to be Ola Regel, he was not a phony. It doesn't say any place that he didn't mean it. He felt bad that Klal Yisrael was being made, that the process of Ola Regel was being made more difficult for Klal Yisrael. And yet he did much worse. So the answer is, that was then, and that was some years later. And by that time, he had gotten worse. And then he was in different Nisyonos. So there is a process of decline. Now, one of the fascinating shayas, I have to give credit, he certainly saved me a ton of time, and probably a lot of these marimakos I never would have found, but there's a sefer I use from time to time, Nachla Shimon Krasno from Ner Yisrael, who does a good job bringing together the various sources on different issues in Tanakh. So he discusses the issue of Lo Yasser Shevet Miyehuda. The famous brachas of Yaakov Avinu in Parshas Vayechi at the end of Yaakov's life. So he said that the king, the Shevet, which represents Melucha, it doesn't actually mean Melucha, but it represents it, would not be removed from Yehuda. So that was a prediction that once the Malchus came to Yehuda, which turned out to be Malchus Beis David, it would never be taken away. And yet here it is being taken away, and no less by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. And this was the Nevuah of Achi Ashiloni. How does that correspond with the Nevuah of Yaakov Avinu? How is it that it contradicts what was said in the Torah? So there are a number of different approaches. We will try to discuss several of them. We'll start with the Ramban. And this is as interpreter Rabbeinu Bechaya. It could be that there are some nuances which could be learned differently in the Ramban. But the essence of the Ramban is that Lo Yasser Shevet Miyehuda was not a nevuah. It was not a prophecy, it was a tzivui. It was a command. Yaakov Avinu was commanding Klal Yisrael, of course, api nevuah, notice he can't make his own commands, but it was a command to Klal Yisrael that once the Malucha was given to Yehuda, it should not be removed. And he says, therefore, in fact, Klal Yisrael violated that command by allowing other kings. The Aseres HaShvatim was in violation of the Tzibu of Yaakov Avinu. But there was never, according to the Ramban, a prediction that it had to be that way. Klal Yisrael has Bechira. You're supposed to be that way. But if you choose to violate it, then it's an Avera. The question is, but the Avachi HaShiloni, the Navi, said to do it. So says the Ramban, that was only for one king, for Yeravam ben Nevat. And there is such a thing as a Navi overriding a Din Torah, Haraz Shah, on a temporary basis. The classic example is Eliyahu Bahar HaKarmel, which I don't know when we'll get up to it, but one of these years we should get up to it. Eliyahu went on Har HaKarmel and brought a carbon outside the base of Mikdash at a time that it was prohibited. Haraz Shah, he wasn't doing it as a regular routine, but a special situation. So there's a special situation that was necessary for Yerovam to be king, but what should have happened was after Yerovam's kingdom was over, they should have rejoined Malchus Beis David. They didn't. That was a chait on the part of Klal Yisrael. Yes?
How do you reconcile that? The Torah says that Navi is going to say the menorah.
That's only if it's permanent.
Yeah, how do you know?
No, because they, that we, what?
As a predictive, as a preventive measure, how do you know the difference?
It depends what the Navi is saying. If the Navi is saying you should do this, there's no longer a mitzvah, if Eliyahu would have said there's no longer a mitzvah, an avera of bringing karbanos outside the Beis HaMikdash, they would have thrown him out. They should have thrown him out. But if he says we're doing it today, and tomorrow we go back to the halacha, so then you believe in Navi. So if the Navi is saying this is for... What?
Doesn't that make it easier to Navi just say that do it temporarily and then another day and then...
Well, then he's not a Navi. A Navi isn't going to, if he's a Navi checker, but you'll catch on after a while if he says another day. But the Navi is, so that's the power of Nevuah. Kadosh Baruch Hu said it could be that a mitzvah would be suspended l'fi shah. Where, by the way, we came across this before, we can remember that far back, at least according to some interpretations, when the Beis Hamikdash was dedicated, they ate and did melacha on Yom Kippur. And that was also Al-Pi Nevi'im. It's considered a Hara Shah. If he would have said, now that we have a Beis Hamikdash, we don't have to fast on Yom Kippur anymore, that would be a Navi Sheker. Lo Sosif Lo Sigur. You can't add and subtract from the Torah. But if he said, this year we're not fasting on Yom Kippur, and he's a chazakah that the person is a kosher Navi, then you could listen to him. So the Ramban says that this was only intended temporarily for Yerubim himself, but not for future generations. Now, just to go through the scope of history, because as we contrast the various Mepharshim, we'll see if they're able to explain all the situations. There is a second time in history where we find this issue being raised, and that was during the Bayis Sheni. In the early years of the Bayis Sheni, Klal Yisrael did not really have any kings. Klal Yisrael really was not an independent country. They were subjugated originally to Malchus Paras, then to the Greeks, and then to the Romans. They were really hardly independent at all, except for a very brief period under the Chashmonaim. The Chashmonaim were criticized for taking on the role of kings. And there too, the Ramban says they violated the mitzvah of Lo Yasser Sheved Mi Yisrael, Mi Yehuda, but there was no nevuah. They were able to become kings. So they violated it, but they they succeeded, so to speak, but they were punished for it because it wasn't the right thing to do. Just a little bit of historical background, because this is also very much misunderstood. The Chashmonaim, first of all, became kings L'shem Shemayim. And that, we know, we probably heard that, they did L'shem. Why did they become kings, though? What was the L'shem Shemayim? What happened? Contrary to the propaganda that you might hear from your Hanukkah stories as a child, the Chashmonaim did not really win the war against the Greeks. The closest modern parallel, for those who want to find parallels, the Chashmonaim won the war against the Greeks in the same way that Vietnam won the war against the United States. The way Vietnam won the war against the United States was not that they really defeated the United States. They just refused to be defeated themselves. And they hung in there. And after a while, it was because of political reasons, the United States got sick and tired of the battle and they pulled out. That's basically what happened with the Greeks. For a different dynamic, it wasn't because there were television broadcasts of all the Greek casualties. You know, it wasn't because of the Greek presidential elections. But there were coups and revolutions and kings were being deposed and they had to go back home and they couldn't fight the battle and generals were rebelling and they had all kinds of problems. So in the end, the war of the Chashmonaim ended through peace negotiations. They must have had some round table in Paris or something. It doesn't say any place in Chazal where these negotiations took place. You know, I don't know if they had Henry Kissinger or whoever else, the UN, but there was peace negotiations. So and in fact, by the way, just for the record, when the Beis Hamikdash was rededicated in the time of the Chashmonaim, they had not even come close to winning the war yet. And they only had recaptured part of Yerushalayim. And they were only able to go up to the Beis Hamikdash from one side. But if they tried to go up from the other side, they were within range of the archers of the enemy. So they couldn't go up to Beis Hamikdash on that side of the hill. It was only the other side of the hill. So it wasn't exactly easy street. But eventually they negotiated a treaty, a settlement. And the Chashmonaim felt that in order to negotiate with the Greek kings and to be on an equal footing and to be taken seriously, they had to be kings too. And that was the reason they did it. That was the L'shem Shemayim. They were wrong. Because they were violating the rest of Shevet. And as much Mesiris Nefesh and Bitachon that the Chashmonaim had, that after all, these are people who engage in a battle against crazy odds. When the battle started, they had literally a handful of people against the whole Greek army. Later, they had more supporters. But tremendous bitachon and tremendous mesiris nefesh. But at this point in time, they should have not taken the role of as a king. They should have just been the military leaders. And they should have gone without a king, as they had until then, and still conducted the negotiations. And it would have worked. Or, well, hopefully it would have worked. But that was the reason why they became kings. But according to the Ramban, there was no prophecy to the contrary. However, they violated the mitzvah, so to speak, the law of Lo Yaseh Shevet Miyuda. We will discuss this a little further next week.